Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Matt Bennett. He's the co-founder and senior vice president for public affairs of a Washington think tank and advocacy organization called Third Way. It's dedicated to a center-left approach that is reasonable and able to reach across party lines. He was previously on the program a couple years ago. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's just start with a brief overview of your organization. Tell me a little bit about Third Way.
Sure. Third Way kind of picked up on the governing philosophy of Bill Clinton, for whom many of us worked. We are a center-left advocacy and organization think tank, as you noted. We work on an array of topics from national security to energy to the economy. And we are seeking approaches that are progressive but that are doable in divided government.
And you've argued recently that the Democratic Party is in really bad shape as a party, despite apparently having large-scale demographic changes on its side and appearing to be in increasingly better shape anyway for keeping the White House, which it's held for 8 years. So tell me, how is the Democratic Party in such bad shape?
Yeah, I think having the White House for 8 years has covered up real rot below the waterline, and I don't think Democrats are aware of how bad things have gone. From 2009, which was really the apex of Democratic fortunes in the modern era, Democrats have, of course, lost control of both houses of Congress and now suffer the worst kind of minority status in the House that they've had since 1933. They have a chance of getting back the Senate, but then they could lose it again quite easily in 2018. But then even worse, at the state level, we're down to 17 governors. Just one-third of governors are Democrats. And we went in 2009, we controlled 60 of the 99 state legislatures. We now control 30. So two-thirds to one-third, losing more than 900 state legislative seats out of some 5,000. So things have been just terrible for Democrats down the ballot from the president last 8 years or so.
And I imagine as you lay that out, then, that if the White House were to go Republican, a lot of things could really flip quite dramatically in terms of where policy direction goes. Is that one of the things that, as a Democrat, as a center-left Democrat, you're worried about?
Of course. You know, we're very worried. The only kind of breaking mechanism, of course, is the Senate. There's no chance that a Republican president, if we were to have one, would have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. So the Senate could slow things down and make it difficult. But what is happening even more fundamentally, way down the ballot, is that there is not much of a bench for Democrats. We don't have a lot of governors. We don't have a lot of state legislators who could run for Congress. And the Republicans are in such solid control of the states, it's going to be very difficult when it comes to redistricting. They're doing a lot of things to restrict voting rights. So it's very bad news.
And so the big question then is, and the difficult one, I suppose, is why? Why is it in such bad shape? What's happened?
Well, that is a very controversial question. There's no doubt that in some places Democrats have suffered because people don't like the president. Every time you control the White House in the modern era, it gets hard for your allies in certain places. And to some extent, there's racism involved. And to some extent, it's just anti-Obama fever. But that has hurt Democrats down ballot in a lot of places. We would argue, though, that there's another reason, which is that the narrative the Democrats have been offering to the middle class has been not connecting the way that we would hope it would. And middle class voters just do not believe that their lives are going to get better if Democrats are in office.
So what does it need to do?
Well, if you look at what Democrats have been saying to the middle class, and we did a bunch of focus group testing earlier this year, they are getting their message across. Democrats are saying the deck is stacked, you are being screwed by powerful forces out of your control, and that is the reason for your economic anxiety. And voters are hearing that, but it isn't resonating for them for a couple of reasons. One is they believe that the world has changed in fundamental ways, that technology and globalization have made it very difficult to maintain a middle-class life the way that you could in the 80s or 70s or even the 90s, and that government hasn't adjusted to account for those changes. They don't believe necessarily that it is the rigged system and the stacked deck that is the cause of their anxiety. And until we are doing things that connect with them at that level, it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to win.
So you're, it sounds like you're talking about then the path forward for the party is what perhaps a political scientist, my tribe, would call some kind of fundamental realignment of the policy message, some kind of new way of thinking about the world that then puts more people under their tent. So can you tell me a little bit about what those things might be?
Sure, that's exactly right. And just take a look at the kinds of things Democrats have focused on. All things that I, as a Democrat, and my organization as a center-left organization support. So, for example, raising the minimum wage, which is a worthy policy goal, and it is popular broadly. The problem is that middle-class voters, who are really the kingmakers of American politics, they might support raising the minimum wage, but that isn't going to help them. By definition, if you get the minimum wage, you're not in the middle class. So talking about the minimum wage means you're talking about someone else. So to your point, Democrats have to do and say things that make middle-class voters believe that they're concerned about them, about their fortunes and their lives. So there's a whole host of things that Democrats could and we think should be doing that would connect them more directly to the lives of the middle class. There's investments in infrastructure and education, things that really are going to make sure that their kids can have the same kinds of opportunities that they've had, and that's what people are the most anxious about.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Matt Bennett, Senior Vice President for Public Affairs at the think tank Third Way. I wanted to get your take on a couple of candidates that, and we're talking here in the third week of November, but several of the candidates that are currently in the mix at the presidential level. The most surprising, perhaps, Donald Trump. I mean, what do you make of the support for Donald Trump?
Well, I have to say that, like everyone else in politics, I'm shocked that the summer of Trump turned into the fall of Trump. Mm-hmm. Nobody really, meaning the autumn, not the actual fall, in the verb sense. It's astonishing. His staying power is amazing. And every time the smart set in Washington believes that he's done something to hurt himself, it turns out it's helped him. So it's very difficult for mainstream political commentators, including me, to tell you anything interesting about Trump. I do think, though, that after the Paris attacks and with the world seeming a little more serious, perhaps, than it did a few weeks ago, that it's going to be difficult in the long run for a guy like Trump to attract support when he gets to big states. Remember, in Republican politics, unlike Democratic, Iowa almost never chooses the winner. They always go with somebody like Rick Santorum or Mike Huckabee, somebody pretty radical who doesn't end up winning the nomination. On the other side, Democrats in Iowa always pick the winner. But so it's likely that somebody like Trump or Carson will win in Iowa. But I think when you get to big states, when deep pools of voters, a little bit more moderate, I think you'll end up with a more mainstream candidate.
And you mentioned Ben Carson. I had a question about him, too. And it's a little different one, which is, what took the media so long to get on the trail of some of his strange opinions? I mean, I had folks emailing me similar stuff months before now this is all coming out.
Well, I think you can't underestimate how important it is that journalists are people, and they are influenced by what they are, the attacks being leveled at them. The Republicans have done a spectacular job of training their anger at the media. And I think one of the results of that has been that they were cautious about delving too deeply into the intellect or the worldview of a guy like Ben Carson, who is celebrated properly for many of the things that he's done in his life, but it's now become clear does not have any of the intellectual grounding that you would need to be president of the United States. And that's a tough thing for media to do, particularly with a kind of folk hero of the right, a Republican who happens to be African-American. There are a lot of reasons that it made it difficult for people to delve into Carson too deeply.
Mm. Now, you're all about center-left politics, but we've got Bernie Sanders here, and certainly, again, different kind of appeal than Trump, both in terms of the policy positions, but also the style of what he's doing. What do you make of the support for him?
I think it's very natural. He is tapped deeply into a vein of kind of base supporters among the Democratic Party. I think he's done a very good job of doing that. We've seen this often in Democratic politics. Howard Dean tapped into that same vein of voters. I do think he's hit his ceiling. He seems to be hovering at around 23% of Democratic primary voters. That's about as high as I thought he would go, and I don't think he's going to go any higher. The big question is going to be, do those voters remain engaged? And if Clinton becomes the nominee, do they line up behind her? And our hope and expectation is that they will.
And on that point, and even taking it further into the future, I was wondering what your take was as to whether or not his campaign is going to lead to something with more lasting effect in terms of having a stronger voice on the left, and something that might then lead to mobilizations around policy positions and policy options or other candidates down the road.
Could be. He's already having an impact on Clinton. Mm-hmm. She is talking about things that she didn't talk about in 2008, and that's attributable to him and to his supporters. What really will determine that, though, is the outcome of the 2016 election. If Democrats win the election, civil wars don't break out in parties that win presidential elections. They are kept under wraps. Civil wars, as we've seen with Republicans lately, break out when you lose. So if Democrats lose the election, there will be a civil war between people on the left saying we weren't pure enough, we weren't true enough to our core principles, and people in the center saying we've lost touch with the middle class, like me. But if Clinton, who I expect to be the nominee, becomes president, it'll be a debate rather than a war.
I'm Grant Reher, and you're listening to the Campbell Conversations. I'm talking with Matt Bennett. He's the co-founder and senior vice president for public affairs at the Washington, D.C.-based think tank Third Way. Well, there's an apparent paradox, it seems to me, in current presidential politics, that people say on the one hand they're frustrated with the level of nastiness and political polarization and extremism in Washington, the inability to find compromise, the inability to work across the aisle, which is one of the things your organization is dedicated to. But as we've been talking about here, at least in the early stages of this presidential election season, they seem to be gravitating toward figures further out from the center. Now, authenticity has been thrown out as one of the explanations of this, and particularly for Donald Trump. But certainly Sanders' appeal, you spoke to this a few minutes ago, you know, you can't see that only in that light. So how do you explain that paradox, that dynamic?
Well, I think there's two things. One is it's clear that this is the season of authenticity and anger. And I think authenticity and anger have gone hand in glove in this season. If you look at the Kentucky governor's race, which was wrapped up last month, this governor-elect Matt Bevin is a kind of Trump-style, angry, authentic guy. And that seems to resonate with a slice of the electorate. But the other thing is these are different people out there in the electorate. There are the people, as you say, who are seeking common ground, who are disgusted with paralysis and gridlock, are not necessarily the same people that are going to Sanders rallies or to Trump events. And I do think that the people with the loudest voices at the moment, the people who are driving, propelling these angry candidates forward, are not the same as the plurality of the electorate who really would like politicians just to do their job again.
So political observers usually hate the questions I'm about to ask, but I do want to ask them to you anyway. And this is really going to be torturous because, again, we're talking a little bit before this airs. But you said earlier that you thought Hillary Clinton would ultimately be the Democratic nominee. What's your confidence level in that outcome?
99.8%.
Wow. Okay.
I think that there's virtually no way that she is not the nominee unless some external event happens to her physically or to her legally or otherwise that would be a meteorite in this election season. But otherwise, she will be the nominee.
And is that in part because of the extensive network of ground operations and the infrastructure of the campaign that she's built that no one else really has an analog to?
Yes. And I think also she has two rivals, one of whom is very weak and just accepted federal funds and is probably on his way out. And the other is Sanders. And I think, as I said, he has a ceiling and he's hit it.
Now, what about the Republican hopefuls? Which one If you had to put money on one, what would it be?
I am really glad I don't have to put money on one because I would have lost a lot of money. Look, I've said for a long time that Jeb Bush could be the John Kerry of this race, which is to say John Kerry was being declared dead as of late December of 2003, moved his entire operation to Iowa and came from behind and won the nomination. I think that could happen with Jeb. If it doesn't, I think it'll be Rubio.
And again, your confidence level in saying those things.
8%.
Okay. We have a different view of the Republicans than the Democrats. A tougher one, perhaps. But let's fast forward to the general election. Do you think there's a good chance that Hillary Clinton will be our first female president?
I do. I think if you look at the general election, in contrast to what we were discussing earlier with what's happened to Democrats down ballot, Democrats actually have quite an advantage in the Electoral College at the moment. There are really only 10 swing states left. And if Hillary wins five of them, if they're the right ones, and this means she could lose both Florida and Ohio and Virginia, she's the president. All she needs is 270 electoral votes, and then she's president. And she starts off with about a 30 electoral vote advantage and an advantage in some of those swing states. So to coin a term, the deck is stacked against the Republicans when it comes to Democratic politics. And so I do think she's in pretty good shape.
But I want to connect her in the general election back to something you were talking about earlier. And it's what the citizens are looking for, and particularly people in the middle classes. It does seem that the public does want the political system as a political system to change in some fundamental way. Can she realistically and believably be a change agent? I mean, if you try to separate the world into the world of candidates into change agents and continuity agents, she's definitely in the continuity camp. So how does that play out for her?
Yeah, that's the biggest question at the heart of her general election struggle, which is how do you be the change candidate? And look, she is running for a third term as a Democrat, and we don't hand out third terms around here very often. George H.W. Bush won one, but before that, it's been a while. So, and the reason is exactly what you point to, which is that after 8 years, people generally want to change. If she's running against a candidate of change like Marco Rubio, she's going to have a tough time. And I think despite her Electoral College advantage, she could lose. But I do think she will find a way to put a little bit of distance very respectfully between herself and Obama. She will say one of the things that she wants to change is the dysfunction in Washington and that she knows how to do it. And I think she can do that in a credible way.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Matt Bennett from the organization Third Way. All right, well, let's look across the world now. What is the center-left ground and position on international affairs at the moment?
Another great question, very difficult to find one. The Obama doctrine doesn't exist. He has, famously his team has said that it's not making stupid mistakes. He used a saltier term and not doing stupid things. And that's fine as far as it goes. But it's very difficult to articulate exactly what Democrats stand for, because he's obviously our leader in every way, especially when it comes to foreign affairs. That said, we have always articulated a foreign policy and national security position of one of being tough and smart. And if you look at the way that Republicans ran the world under George W. Bush, we would regard that as tough but reckless, invading Iraq obviously being Exhibit A. We think you need to be willing to use force. You need to not be afraid. It should be a last resort. We should do it with our allies, but resolute in the face of threats like ISIS, and toughness in responding to the very many things that threaten the security of the United States. That isn't a very coherent and nicely, tightly wrapped package, but this is a very complicated world.
And what about that question you mentioned, ISIS, of handling extremism in the Middle East? Now the conversation seems to have shifted into one of the degree to which we involve ourselves, again, militarily. Is your organization trying to influence that discussion at all?
We are, but we're talking about very small angels dancing on very small pins at the moment. Nobody thinks that we should withdraw from Syria, nobody other than some fairly serious radicals on both sides. And nobody really is saying that we should have a massive several hundred thousand troop ground force presence in Syria and Iraq either. So what we're talking about is really between the 40-yard lines. Should we have 1,000 special operators or 10,000? Should we be working directly with the Russians or not so much? So, yes, we have points of view on these things, but the differences between Democrats and Republicans and centrists and liberals are not anything like they were during the Iraq War, for example.
But I do think, though, that a lot of the public has a deeper and deeper yearning for something that they would regard as peace. We seem to be in this situation of continual war in a time of peace, if that makes sense. So how do you see the possibility of a serious and effective peace movement coming out of the center rather than coming out of the left? Because that's where the real serious efforts, I think, at what would be regarded as peace are coming from right now.
Well, I think if you look at the example of Israel and what has happened to the peace movement in Israel, which is to say that it no longer really exists. There used to be a very vibrant peace movement, but it was kind of ground down by terrorist attacks. And I think that could be what happens here, too. The peace movement in the United States, notwithstanding your point, which is correct, that everybody is yearning for it, is pretty weak in the face of these barbaric attacks from these horrible people, the likes of which we really haven't seen since the Nazis. And it's going to be very hard to argue that we should not be fighting them.
Other areas of the world that Third Way looks at and focuses attention on for trying to change policy discussion? Is it China? Where do you focus your attention when you're not thinking about the obvious question of what the Middle East needs to be doing?
Well, we actually have limited our foreign policy scope to U.S. national security policy, which sounds like a distinction without a difference. But actually what we'd focus on more is how should our intelligence community be structured, what should we be doing with our defense and veterans, and less on precisely what our policy should be vis-a-vis China or Taiwan. To have influence in those discussions, you have to dive very, very deep. You have to be in touch with the deputy assistant secretary for this or that every day, and that's just not our work.
Well, that was Matt Bennett. Matt, it was good to talk with you again.
Great to be back. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.